All right, hey everybody, I'm Julian, I'm an alcoholic. Let's have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the Napa Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. All right, I have the privilege tonight of introducing our speaker. I've just recently started to get to know Whit, and I can tell you that I find him to be a kind and gentle and loving human being. And I'm interested in his story because not a lot of us start off as kind and gentle and loving human beings. So maybe he's going to tell us a story of transition. But here it is, Whit.
Right. Hello, everybody. My name is Whit, and I do qualify as an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 17th, 2003. Somewhere I got my notes in here. I'll reveal a little bit about my age. I was born in 1944 and spent the first 18 months of my life up at Fort Knox, Kentucky. My daddy was head of the tank gunnery school during the Second World War. And then we moved down to a little town south of here called Griffin, Georgia, down in Spalding County. Great, great, great little town. I'll qualify myself from a heredity standpoint. It'll come out later in my story. But I found out much, much later on that my daddy's mother, who I never knew, she died in 1943, was known as a hopeless alcoholic. I held my father's hand in 1987 when he died of alcoholic cirrhosis, but I never would have called my father an alcoholic. But later on during my story, you'll see why, because a huge amount of our interaction was during the drinking process. Spent my early childhood down in Griffin. I would say I'd qualify as somebody that was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I never wanted for anything. One of my best friends down there, his daddy, was a dairy farmer and a chicken farmer. He had a terrific farm north of Griffin and grew up hunting and fishing, doing great, great things all the time. No issues. As a matter of fact, they had the first private swimming pool built in their backyard, so we always had a pool to go swim in. I can't ever remember wanting anything and not really having it at my disposal. You probably could say I was probably a spoiled brat, and I might have qualified for that. Grew up in Griffin. We used to go down to the Atlantic Beach Hotel. My grandfather, my daddy's father, started taking his kids down there in, by train. My daddy grew up in Birmingham. And we went to the old Atlantic Beach Hotel. And I remember as a kid, and I'm talking about a kid, shuffling around on the big old deck patio they had overlooking the ocean, and always being able to run by a table and having a sip of whatever they happened to be drinking. And never tasted anything I didn't like. And most of it was alcohol. Later on, I remember growing up, my daddy's best friend was an attorney down in Griffin, and he didn't drink whiskey, but he loved, y'all ever remember the little country club malt liquors? I think they came in like 6 ounce or 8 ounce cans. We always had, Jim was a country club malt liquor guy, and daddy always had country club malt liquor available for Jim. And I remember being able to, as a toddler almost, being able to go to the refrigerator and occasionally get a country club malt liquor out and have a drink. No questions, no problems, no issues. In my early teenage years, it was not just occasionally, but I could go probably 3 or 4 times a week and actually have a beer and just sit down. And I was doing this in front of my parents. It was never an issue. I wasn't denied any of that. We moved. I went off to my freshman year in high school. Wound up being a terrific event for me because the twin sister of one of my best friends, whose father owned all the lakes and the farm, started dating a senior football player as soon as we got to our freshman year in high school. And the beauty about that was all of a sudden us guys and her new boyfriend became best friends because he liked the same thing we did. He liked to hunt and fish and play and do all that stuff. But we had wheels. He could drive. We all drove, but not legally. But he had a car, a 1951 Ford, if I remember correctly. And we would go out, and we'd go to the farm, just the guys, and do whatever we wanted to do. But there was always beer involved. By that time, I was just a regular old beer drinker. Later on, I went off to a little school. There was some issues going on, not to insult anybody, but back then, George Wallace was raising hell about integration over in Alabama, but the governor of Georgia quietly put out an edict and said if they tried to integrate any public school in the state of Georgia, he would close every public school in the state of Georgia. So all of us, out of fear, not of integration, but out of fear of the schools being closed, went to a private school. And a lot of my friends came up here to Marist and other places. I wound up at a place called the Sewanee Military Academy up in Sewanee, Tennessee, and spent my 3 years in high school up there. Didn't drink there because it just wasn't available. Occasionally we'd go to the Grand Ole Opry up in Nashville and sneak out and have a beer or two while we were up there. But every summer we went down to Ponte Vedra at that particular point in time, just south of Jacksonville Beach. And I remember going up to the surf club, which was the club foot of the Ponte Vedra golf course and all that stuff, and sitting by the pool and ordering a vodka and tonic, and you couldn't pay for it. You had to sign the ticket. And I never had a question from my father or my mother on who was drinking up at the pool with me because they just didn't care. And I could go back and get a beer out of the refrigerator. I was still a beer drinker in front of them, but drinking vodka on the side. Finished up high school and went down to a good old place called Auburn University, War Eagle. And went through Rush and joined a fraternity down there. And that's when the hard liquor really hit me. And I became a constant and consistent Jack Daniels drinker. Love Jack Daniels. Studied architecture for 2 years until calculus decided I wasn't going to be an architect. I was a very, very, I won't say a good student, but I took calculus, took algebra the first quarter. I had to take algebra, and it was the same course I had as a senior in high school. And I made an A in it, and I don't really remember even looking at the book. I just took the final exam. And then I took Calculus 1, and I made a C in it. And being a good student, I thought, I decided I really didn't know what Calculus was trying to teach me, so I took it over again and made a D. And so I decided to move on to Calculus 2, and I took it twice, and I flunked it both times. And decided I wasn't going to be an architect and transferred into the School of Business. But I spent, because of that transfer, I went from a first quarter junior to a third quarter freshman as far as quality points go. And so I wound up going to Auburn for 15 quarters. I went three straight summers and graduated. But I was a constant drinker. I was an every night drinker during college. I would come home from school like a lot of people do when they were working. And the first thing I'd do is have a cocktail. It's cocktail time every day. I never recall ever honestly being drunk. but I know I probably was. Nobody just called me on my stuff. Between my freshman year, senior year in high school and freshman year at Auburn, we moved from Griffin to Birmingham. My daddy took a new job. And when I went home for the first time after going down there for my freshman, start my freshman year, it was the annual Auburn-Georgia Tech football game, and that game back then was played in Birmingham when it was a home game. And I remember coming in the door, and Daddy welcomed me and asked me how school was and everything else. And he looked at me and said, "You want to get a beer, or would you rather go to the bar?" And I'm 17 years old. And I said, "I'd rather go to the bar." And from that time on, the bar was open. I could go get a drink anytime I wanted to. I'm not blaming my parents for anything. I'm just saying it was available and I took advantage of it. Had a great time in college. Got my pilot's license my senior year and just used to go out and play. Fly the airplane around. There was no issues. And two of my roommates, who were fraternity brothers, both were in the Air Force ROTC program. And we had an agreement that the night before we went flying, we would not drink. I don't think I adhered to that very well, but it didn't make any difference. I don't ever recall being drunk while I was flying anyway. Graduated from Auburn and moved back to Birmingham, got my draft notice, went down, and believe it or not, after passing the flight physicals to go into the Air Force, I flunked the draft physical down to Montgomery, and went back, called my Air Force recruiter and said, "What do I do?" And he said, "Get doctor's opinions on all this and so forth." I had a little kidney problem that shouldn't have kept me out, but got all the information and went back to report for my class date to go to Lackland Air Force Base to become an Air Force pilot. And I said I should have been reclassified now from temporary 1A. And he said, "You have." And I said, "Well, great. I'm ready to go." He said, "No, you've been reclassified permanent 1-way. You're not eligible." So I went back and got a job, went to work for a little bitty bank in Birmingham called Exchange Security Bank. We were the fourth largest bank in Birmingham at that particular time. They had just celebrated going over $150 million in deposits. And you think about what kind of deposit structure banks have today, that's a postage stamp deposit structure. That little bank's Regions Bank now, and it has grown a little bit. But went to work for them, and a couple of years after I went to work for them, I started their real estate and construction lending division for them, and then started building houses on the side. Several of us in the bank became real close friends, and we would meet up about three or four times a week after work at a bar, a restaurant bar across the street, and have drinks before we went home. I used to meet my daddy for lunch, and we would have martini lunches, and then I'd go back to work. But it was just an ongoing, continuous thing. And again, I don't classify myself at that particular point in time as an alcoholic. And I never would have classified my father as an alcoholic. But we were drinking buddies. Our social interaction was always involved whiskey. Stayed with Exchange Security and then got an offer to go to work for a little bitty bank right down the street. And the guy that hired me or was asking me to come to work, I said, "Well, why should I come down here?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to move up to chairman of the board. The chairman's going to retire in 2 years, and I want you to come down here and start a construction lending, but a commercial lending division like you have at the other bank. and then when I move up to chairman, I'm going to make him president. And I was 29 years old, and that sounded pretty darn good to me, at a 29-year-old to, in 2 years to be president of a little bank. So I started their commercial lending division, and one of it was putting in a loan review process, and when I started the loan review process, I discovered some horrible, horrible loan situations, and had to get the FDIC involved, and they came and made the board raise additional capital. It was a horrible, horrible situation. And they fired the president that had hired me, brought a whole new management team in, and I said, what about me? And they said, well, you're not going to be president anymore. And so I had started building houses and developing real estate on the side while I was with the other bank, and so I went and just did my building company stuff. And that's a huge opportunity to continue to drink, because I carried it around in a car and go and look at my houses and see what was happening, and always had my cup with me. It wasn't quite this big, but it was always by my side, and the bottle was always under the seat. There was no issue. Excuse me. Continued to do that, and then we, a group of us, five of us, bought a little dormant mortgage company in Birmingham called Leedy Mortgage Company. Leedy had actually made the first FHA loan ever made in the United States. And the owner of the company had retired down in Sea Island. He was just living off the servicing income. And we cranked that thing back up, and I hit the road traveling, calling on investors. And back then, the mortgage business was truly a mortgage business, where the mortgage company made the loans. They sold them in packages to investors, but they collected the payments. They got a little percentage of each payment as their income. But I used to travel up to New York and go drive all the way from Buffalo over to Hartford, Connecticut, and so forth, calling on little S&Ls and so forth. And I don't know whether this fueled drinking or anything else, but driving and being by myself and so forth continued to increase that. While I was with that company, I got married. I married a girl that had been married before and had gotten divorced. She had three children. The husband, her former husband, was an attorney who was a friend of mine. And I went to Ken and I said, Ken, would you allow me to adopt the kids? I want to create a family. And he just said, why, sure. And I looked back at that. He was getting out of three child support payments and an alimony payment, and he knew I wasn't going to keep the kids away from him, but he was awfully agreeable to do that. And we did create a family, and then my son, my biological son, was born shortly after that. And I was continuing to travel everywhere. We sold Leedy. Leedy was gone. And I was doing consulting work all over the Eastern Seaboard. Spent 4 months doing consulting work for the largest Swedish hotel firm, building their landmark in New York City. They furnished me a suite on the 53rd floor of the Helmswood Palace Hotel. And all of that continued, I think, to increase my consumption. Because there was no reason not to drink. I was always on my own, could do what I wanted to do. I didn't have to make any real appearances and be somewhere where I didn't have to drink. My wife said, you got to stop traveling. You're missing your son grow up. Come back, settle down, get a job. So I went to work for the largest S&L in the state of Alabama in 1985, and right after I went to work for them, we went from a mutual S&L where the shareholders owned the S&L to a stock S&L. We went public, sold stock, so we had a good net worth. And about 6 to 8 months after I went to work for them, the S&L crisis hit, and I'm sure a lot of y'all remember when the SNL crisis hit and the SNLs were being closed down all over the country. And since we were a stock SNL instead of a mutual, we were probably one of the first that FISLIC, which is the FDIC, or was the FDIC of the SNL industry, called to go look at other SNLs to take over. Suddenly I became head of the, quote, due diligence committee to go analyze these banks they wanted us to buy. And I was on the road again. Spent 4 months in the same hotel I spent my honeymoon in down in New Orleans. We bought the largest SNL in Louisiana. Bought some in Alabama, bought one here in Georgia. And it just progressively got worse. My drinking. And again, I never admitted I had a problem. I just was enjoying what I was doing. It was just working for me. So, quit that, came back to Birmingham, and I had met, while I had Leedy Mortgage Company, I had met a guy over here up in Flowery Branch, Georgia, and we had put together a deal with some property across from Amicalola Falls, and we're going to build a bottled water plant up there. We were first going to develop the property and sell real estate, but we discovered some pure artesian water, and we're going to build a bottled water plant and sell water. He screwed the whole deal up, and I hadn't seen him in years, and all of a sudden I was over here at a soccer tournament in Atlanta and ran into him. And he found out I was working for this SNL in Alabama and brought me some business. And I was stupid enough to do some business with him, knowing what had occurred with our joint venture years ago. And found out that he had supplied me with some fraudulent appraisals, some bad paper and so forth. This is after I left the SNL and had gone back into business for myself. And all of a sudden the FBI came knocking on my door one day, and they decided I was a co-conspirator of him in this bank fraud situation. The attorneys told me I could be found innocent. They didn't think I had anything to do with it, but it was going to cost me about $150,000 to defend myself. And so I did what Mr. Johnson might know is called an Alford plea. And it's an A-L-F-O-R-D. It's named after some guy in New York City, from what I understand, the first one that ever did it. And what I did is I said I don't admit any guilt, but I understand the government's case, and I would accept what they have offered as far as the charges. And I went up in front of Judge U.W. Clemens there. He's one of the great federal judges, and fortunately I knew him personally. It probably was a bad deal, but he sentenced me to 5 years probation. And I was fortunate enough, but I went from being a neat guy that had a terrific reputation and could do anything in the business world to being on the front page of the Birmingham News with a picture. And the way the newspaper said it is I pled guilty to bank fraud. And after that, everything I did in my life continuously after that became all about me. All I wanted to do was be a superstar success and get my name back. And boy, did I start hammering the bottle. I would probably drink. I have a saying called white whiskey in light and dark whiskey at night. And so I drank vodka all day and bourbon all night. Again, I never recall being drunk, but I never I probably was constantly drunk and never recall actually being sober, maybe looking back on it, the way things were going. Continued to do all kind of crazy things with my finances, trying to make a big hit. It's almost like playing the lottery here in Georgia, except instead of buying a $1 or $2 ticket, I was buying $100,000, $200,000 tickets, and lost everything I'd made over a long period of time. Probably the only thing successfully I'd ever done is when I'd sold my little house before we got married. I took all the equity I had in it and bought a half interest in my ex-wife, well, she wasn't my ex-wife yet, but my wife's house, and paid off the mortgage so the house was free and clear. But I never recorded that deed, so she was the sole owner of that house in the lot next door, which I had bought. I had gone all the way down to where that was that was really the only asset I had. I had no money or anything else, and I didn't even have it anymore, and thank God I didn't. She found out that I had forged her name on a deed, not a deed, but a mortgage, and borrowed money against the house. I was fortunate enough to get some money and pay that off. She didn't press charges, but she kicked me out of the house and said, "We're through. Go." So I left and moved out, stayed in Birmingham trying to piddle around, and we started a company. I had some friends that I had known me in the banking business who gave me a second chance, and we started a little company called Regional Nuclear Pharmaceuticals, which was to do a diagnostic routine called PET scanning, positron emission tomography. And during my research, I decided the only way we could do it successfully was also build a plant that made the radioactive isotope that this scanner was reading. So it wound up being about a $5.5-6 million project. It went real well. I got the financing for them, put it together, but the issues came out that I was calling on doctors in hospitals and was noticeably reeking of alcohol while I was making presentations and so forth, and they fired me. And so I walked away from a $150,000 a year job and 20% of the company, and they took it all back, and they were smart to do that. Met a gal online and moved down to Columbus, Georgia. And she was known as my drunk girlfriend long before I was known as her drunk boyfriend. So the two of us got together and merged real well with each other. And stayed in Columbus, never could get a decent job, and really lived off her. She had a real good job. And it got downhill, 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 and finally she kicked me out. The only time I've ever had this happen, and it only happened once, is I was driving around the lake bottom area of Columbus, which is where Columbus High School is, and the public parks, and people jogging, and softball fields, and all that stuff, taking down phone numbers of places to rent, rooms to rent. And the last thing I remember is writing the phone number down about 7:20 that afternoon and waking up on the kitchen floor at 9:30 that night, driving around Columbus in a total blackout. And I was laying on the kitchen floor because she had pushed me when I walked in, when they drug me out of the car, and I fell over. And the next morning, she was on the phone with my sister saying, "You've got to come get him. He can't stay here anymore. He's out." My sister has a master's degree in addiction counseling and got me on the phone and said, "Do you have a problem?" I said, "I don't know. I think probably I do." And so she recommended a little place here in Atlanta called MAR, Metropolitan Atlanta Recovery Residences. and had me call them, and I did an interview on the phone, and they accepted me. And but they didn't have a bed opening. This was on a, I think it was on a Tuesday or something like that. They didn't have a, no, it was on a Wednesday, and they didn't have a bed opening until the Friday of the following week. And I said, okay. And then the heavy warning was, and you cannot have a drink 72 hours before you arrive, or else you might have to go to detox, and that costs extra money. I said, okay. So I made plans to stop drinking 72 hours before, but that meant I could drink for about 10 more days, which was great. Next day I got a call, and they told me they had an opening that Wednesday, and if I would come right up, that would be great. The hardest thing I did at that particular point in time was to say okay, because I was going, my mind was set to say, okay, heck, I'll just wait until the following Friday, like I originally told. But I finally admitted it and headed up to Atlanta and checked in tomorrow on a Wednesday afternoon. And it's a 90-day program. And my thought process was, I can quit drinking for 90 days. That's not a real issue. Excuse me. Got up to Atlanta, went through the check-in process, and excuse me, Mara has a little thing called community meetings on Wednesday afternoon, and I got taken over to the apartment that I was going to move into, and you have to introduce yourself, tell them a little bit about yourself, the guys, four guys that you're going to move in with, or three guys, three other guys, and four guys from an apartment next door. And so I introduced myself and so forth, and then a guy named Ben from Raleigh, North Carolina, he was an attorney. When they opened it up for people to talk, Ben said, I have something I want to talk about. And they said, okay, Ben, what you want? He said, well, I've been here 87 days. And I said, God dang, I'm just going to move in, and he's going to move right out 3 days later. I won't even get to know the guy. And he said, I've been talking to treatment team, and he said, I really don't feel like I'm ready to leave, and they're going to let me stay in halfway for 30 more days. I'll share. Well, what do you want? Isn't that the whole purpose of being here? Get the hell out in 90 days? And everybody laughed at me. So I went ahead, settled in. Next night I was at Tucker Turtles, where I met my sponsor. Didn't meet him. I met him that night, but he didn't become my sponsor. One of the things Mara made us do is in 14 days to get off Buddy, you had to get a sponsor. So I did that. When I was in Columbus, I went to AA meetings. I never heard anything about the Big Book. I never heard anything about the 12 Steps. I never even had a Big Book. Never got a sponsor. Never did anything. Then I would go drive around Columbus and go back to home. I was drinking the whole time and tell Marcia what a wonderful meeting it was. And so this was a new deal to me to really get involved. When I was leaving, packing up in Columbus to come tomorrow, my sister said, now be sure you take your Big Book. And I said, my what? She said, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never heard of the Big Book, even though I went to AA meetings in Columbus for a while. But anyway, after that meeting, I secretly walked over to the door and circled November the 19th on the calendar, because that was in my 90 days, and I was going to be gone in 90 days. Something happened along the way, and I checked out on October the 5th of the next year. So I spent 13 and a half months there. Only 90 days and halfway, but I stayed in three quarters quite a while. My awakening occurred when I was doing my working on my fourth step, getting ready to do my fifth step. And one of the best things that happened to me was that my sponsor said, here are your worksheets for the fourth step, and I've got you penciled in to do this, and I think it was 10 days away, on this Sunday afternoon. And I said, okay. And I started working on my fourth step, and went to Bill the next time I saw him and said, I'm going to need a little more time. And he said, no, you're not. You're already penciled in. We're going to do it on Sunday afternoon. You be ready. So I continued to work on that, and I cheated because I went and got my big book out to see what kind of wonderful stuff this thing is going to do for me. And I went and got to page 75, if I can find it. What was going to happen after I did this horrible fifth step? And it said, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we've done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelves, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask, have we omitted anything? For we are building an arch through which to walk. A free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones in proper place? Have we skimped on the cement and we put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar out of sand? And that's when I realized I had. I never had picked up white chip because I had no intention of never drinking again. I went back to the first step. And I never admitted my powerlessness. I admitted that my life was unmanageable, but I had never admitted I was powerless over alcohol. And I finally did that admission, knowing hereditary-wise, my grandmother had died of alcoholic cirrhosis. My father had died of alcoholic cirrhosis while I felt his pulse and his heart stopped beating. And I'm sure I had alcohol. I had alcoholism. Thank God I didn't have the cirrhosis part of it. I came up with my three A's for the principles behind the first three steps. Acceptance. I had to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic. Acceptance was for honesty. I had to get honest with me. With you're an alcoholic, and there is a way out. You just got to do the work. Attitude for honesty. Attitude for hope, excuse me. And the hope was that I could do this work and have what you people in the room had. The people that I saw, that I admired, have what you have by doing the work, walking these steps. And then for faith, acceptance and attitude were the first two, and then for faith it was a transfer of trust. And a lady named Paula, she spoke here not too long ago, gave me that as a definition of faith, is transferring trust. And that was the process, again, of getting out of me. And depending on the people in the room, my sponsor, the counselors at Marl that were working with me, and so forth. It was a great, great upheaval. So that was the action part of my three A's: acceptance, attitude, and action. For honesty, hope, and faith. I got involved heavily in the program. Became a servant in my home group. First served as secretary of the Log Cabin Club. Later on, after I got out of MAR, I checked out on Wednesday on October the 5th. I was back in my same apartment on Wednesday, October the 12th, volunteering in the same community meeting that I had introduced myself in 13 and a half months before. Now, I didn't have any of the same roommates, but I had done that. Go to meetings, and I'm a constant. I have two meetings I go to continuously, love them, and it's been a great experience for me. I'm involved in service work with MACI. I'm a pure alcoholic, but my home groups are Cocaine Anonymous. And MACI is Metro Atlanta Cocaine Anonymous Center Group, and happen to be treasurer of that little organization. Have sponsees and working with them. I was fortunate enough to be elected and served as president of the MAR Alumni Association for a couple of years, and then the MAR's board of directors honored me by asking me to serve on the board at MAR for 3 years. So all of a sudden, I say the inmates are running in the asylum, and it was kind of an interesting experience. But I think the big things was coming in, getting a sponsor, getting a home group, and continuously going to meetings and working the program. Just some wonderful, wonderful friends here. I can't think of any time. I remember we were having a little meeting at the log cabin, at the old log cabin before they tore it down. And a guy was up there, and he said, "I got to call." Well, there was only five of us at the meeting. He said, "I got to call my sponsor. I can't talk to him. He's out of the country. I'm just going crazy. I need to talk to my sponsor." And I looked at him and said, "You don't need to talk to your sponsor." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You're here. Talk to us." And that's the way the program has always worked for me. So if you give yourself to the program will give it all back to you. And I thank y'all. I appreciate you offering me the chance to speak. Thank y'all very much.
Thank you, Whit. That is quite a story. I saw you foreshadowing the savings and loan thing there. You are definitely an example of the program in action, how sobriety can change your life. I have asked Chris to come up and give up the chips.
My name is Chris Ward. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And at the Blue Chip speaker meeting and most places in AA, they have a chip system to denote the time away from your last drink. But if you're willing to come in and give this way a try, put down the drink and come in and try this new way of life one day at a time. Come on up and get a white chip. Thanks. After 30 days, we got a silver chip. 30 days. All right. After 90 days, we got a red chip. 90 days in a row, red chip. Yellow chip, 6 months. Green chip for 9 months. And we got a blue chip for years or multiple years.
Yeah. I'm coming up on 21, July 17th.
Okay. We offer the white chip twice.
I got two chips.
Oh, gosh. There you go.
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
It's 13 years. Thanks for the story. You guys what was saying here, 2003. I gave myself to the program and started helping people. I see some pretty people here I haven't seen in a while. And Larry is still alive, and I'm going to give this to my friend Larry.
Any other blue chips? Are we off? Yeah? Nice.
Hi, I'm Pam Shack. It's 10 years.
All right.
this should be a home group, and I want to give it to them.
All right, again, any more blue chips? Okay, we offered the white chip twice in case you'd like to reconsider. The applause woke you up, maybe? All right, thank God for the chips you hold.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Circumstances.